Natural Resources Committee. Again, welcome to everyone. Today's agenda is going to be informational hearings, first from OWEB and secondly from OSU. I'm going to open an informational hearing on the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. And I'd like to call forward, please, Mita Lofsgaarden. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, Mita Lofsgaarden, Executive Director for the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. Thank you for the opportunity to share with you some information about our agency this morning. You'll find in front of you a packet of information that we'll be referring to about our agency's investments. I'm going to have staff from our agency come forward now and talk to you about a couple of different things. First, a really quick overview about our agency's investments since its inception. We're also going to speak briefly to the Sage-Grouse funding that you helped shepherd forward during the last legislative session. And then we want to talk to you about our newly implemented focus investment program. When that's complete, I am glad to come back up here. If there are any general questions that the committee has about our agency, I'd be glad to answer those at that time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And a couple of alums on the committee this morning.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. All right. Please come forward. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here for our early session. I suspect some of you had a ways to travel, so we appreciate your getting up early and making it.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, Renee Davis, Deputy Director at OWEB. So I want to echo Maida's thanks for the opportunity to check in about some new developments at OWEB, including our new Focused Investment Partnerships, or FIP, program. So we have several staff here who will talk with you in more detail about the FIP program shortly. But I wanted to just give you some background and context about the agency more broadly and our investments. And as Maida mentioned, some of the information that I'll be referencing is contained within your packets. So OWEB is a state agency that provides grants to help Oregonians complete voluntary restoration and conservation work around the state. Through OWEB's grant making, we aim to achieve our mission, which is to help protect and restore watersheds that support thriving communities and healthy economies. Courtney, could you advance to slide two? So since 1999, OWEB has awarded $580 million in grants to support watershed-based work. The accomplishments achieved by these grants are quite significant. In terms of habitat restored and improved, over 4,600 miles of stream habitat have been improved, more than 1 million acres of upland habitat, and also nearly 46,000 acres of wetland and estuary habitat have been improved or restored with OWEB funding. In addition, nearly 6,000 miles of fish habitat has been made accessible for use and access by native species. So a few examples of the types of specific restoration actions that are undertaken with OWEB grants include riparian tree plantings to help shade streams, improving or removing inaccessible fish passage barriers, and working with ranchers and farmers to help install irrigation efficiencies that conserve water. Just a few examples of the types of projects that our funds support. So you'll see specifically that the chart shown on the slide demonstrates how OWEB funding to date is distributed among the various grant types that the agency offers. So you can see that the majority of the funding, 55%, goes directly to on-the-ground restoration and conservation work. We also offer a number of other grant types that really are in support of that restoration and conservation. One area I would highlight is the capacity investment that we make in local watershed councils and soil and water conservation districts around the state that really has helped to create an incredibly robust restoration infrastructure in the state. You can see some of the other grant types include monitoring, technical assistance, and outreach, all of which happen in local communities around the state. Could you go to the next slide, please? So OWEB does have in place a long-term investment strategy that helps to guide how its investment portfolio will be managed. The OWEB board adopted the long-term investment strategy in 2013 following passage of ballot measure 76, which permanently dedicated a portion of the state lottery funds to support improvements to water quality and also native fish and wildlife habitat. So the chart does show the investment areas contained within the long-term investment strategy. You can see that the lion's share of the funding for the current biennium spending plan that the board uses goes into open solicitation. That investment area is responsive grant making around the state that addresses locally identified priorities. The remaining approximately 40% of the current board's spending plan is divided between two primary other areas. One is focused investments. These are large-scale collaborative partnerships that aim to achieve specific ecological outcomes. You'll hear a lot more about those shortly from other staff. The other primary investment area is operating capacity. Those are the capacity investments that I mentioned earlier to watershed councils and soil and water conservation districts. So with that, I'll turn it over to Eric Hartstein, who will talk more specifically about some of the sage-grouse-related investments.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, Eric Hartstein, Senior Policy Coordinator with the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. So with leadership from the legislature and the governor's Natural Resource Office, the state of Oregon has made a commitment to restoring and protecting habitat for the greater sage-grouse while advancing sustainable rural economies. In keeping with this commitment, the OWEB board back in April pledged to make available at least $10 million over 10 years across its grant programs for sage-grouse habitat restoration and protection. And since that commitment, over $663,000 has been awarded by OWEB in grants that help landowners and land managers voluntarily protect and restore sage-grouse habitat. So, at least in part, the commitments made by states like Oregon to engage in a collaborative approach to sage-grouse habitat restoration and protection has resulted in a determination by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that greater sage-grouse are not warranted for listing under the Federal Endangered Species Act. Next slide, please. A significant part of OWEB's investment in sage-grouse will be through the Focused Investment Partnership Program. And the Oregon model to protect sage-grouse was recently awarded this distinction of a focused investment by the OWEB board. The partners are strategically working with landowners in Lake, Harney, and Malheur counties, which you can see up here, to implement voluntary actions that will benefit the sage-grouse. Next slide, please. The Oregon model to protect sage-grouse includes six core partners, which you see listed up here, and addresses the sagebrush, sage steppe habitat priority, which was established by the OWEB board back in 2015. The proposed outcomes include the protection of sage-grouse through, again, voluntary habitat restoration projects, such as exotic grass control, juniper removal, and marking fences that are high risk for sage-grouse collisions. And the OWEB board in January awarded this initiative over $2 million for the 2015-2017 biennium. With that, we'll turn it over to Eric Williams.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is Eric Williams. I'm the grant program manager at OWEB. And as Eric just introduced one of the focused investments that our board awarded last month, I'd like to step back a little bit with some background on that focused investment program and then run through the other focused investments that the board awarded last month. We went through a fairly extensive public process for the board to identify priority areas for focused investments. And these focused investments, as their name implies, are intended to try to get as much movement towards desired ecological outcomes as possible within a mid to long-term time frame. In this case, it's a commitment to address funding for these priority areas over a six-year period, one biennium at a time. And so following the board award in January last month, which was a significant event, I think, in our agency's history, in addition to the Sage-Grouse Focus Investment Initiative, the board also made five additional awards, and I'll run through each of those now. If I could have the next slide, please. Oh, Harney Bates, you already had it there. Courtney was ahead of me. The priority areas that the board established, there were seven of them. We received applications for six of those seven, and through a two-stage application process, which went through fairly extensive review with expert reviewers and our board subcommittee on focused investment, we ended up with four of those priority areas being represented among these focus investment awards. The first priority area was sage-grouse, as Eric described. The second one is closed basin wetlands. And this focus investment that's on the slide here is the Harney Basin Wetland Initiative. If you can hit the next slide, please. And in this one, the board awarded a little over $1.6 million to address the outcomes in Malheur Lake of trying to get a handle on the problem of invasive carp in that lake and restore that ecosystem to its former condition. You can see a list of partners there. This is a highly effective partnership, which, by the way, is really a requirement for a partnership to get an award. They have to be what we consider a high-performing partnership, meaning that they have a structure in place to coordinate among the various partners. They have a decision-making process that's written and in place, and they have a strategic action plan, which is fairly specific about the actions that are required to achieve those desired ecological outcomes. Next slide, please. Another ecological outcome priority area is dry type forests. And with this one, the Ashland Forest All Lands Restoration, this partnership is looking to restore that forest type in the ridgeline area above the city of Ashland. Next slide, please. This award is a little over $1.5 million to address the outcome of restoring the dry type forest habitat. And you can see the partner list there, led by the City of Ashland and the Nature Conservancy, the Lomakotze Restoration Project, and NRCS. And as you know, last year was a pretty significant fire season. This application really demonstrated the dual benefits that you often get in restoring an ecosystem here. Another desired outcome of this project is to reduce fuels for wildfires in that area and have a more representative fire regime of natural conditions that would normally occur there. Next slide, please. Next area, ecological focus area that the board awarded focus investments in is native fish. And we had three of these that the board awarded. The first one here is the Upper Grand Ronde Initiative, which you can see on the map there. The highlighted watersheds in gold there are the sub-watersheds that are the focus of this focused investment. They include reaches of the Upper Grand Ronde and Catherine Creek. Next slide, please. This one is a little bit over $1.6 million to this partnership. This one is a partnership that has a really long history of effective work on restoration in this watershed. They've been working and functioning as a partnership for 20 years. And you can see the partner list there is pretty extensive. These groups have worked well together for a long time. That was demonstrated in their application and has a very high likelihood of success. The next one is the Deschutes Partnership. This one was our top-ranking proposal. This partnership has been a highly functioning partnership as well for a long period of time. Next slide, please. Its award was a little over $3.6 million, and the outcomes there are to restore the conditions necessary for the reintroduction of salmon and steelhead into this area of Wyches Creek, Metolius River, and the Crooked River. You can see the partner list there, and those partners, again, have been functioning very well together. We have a history through what was previously called a special investment partnership, where these partners have achieved significant progress toward ecological restoration in the Deschutes. And we have the upper and middle Willamette Anchor Habitats native fish proposal. This one is addressing an area that in this watershed up until about 2008, there hadn't been much going on in terms of restoration, and that's in these main stem Willamette River anchor habitat areas that were mapped initially by the Nature Conservancy, and then further detailed mapping was provided by Oregon State University. Next one. This is a little over $2.3 million, and focuses really on goals related to stream river processes in the floodplain, rehabilitating the floodplain forest, reconnecting the river to its historical floodplain, and increasing channel complexity. All of those things are designed to improve habitat for the native fish species.
Eric, if I could interrupt for just a moment, I think Representative McEwen has a question or comment.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Before we move on, you're using a term I'm not familiar with. What is anchor habitat? How do you define that, please?
An anchor habitat is a term that describes parts of this river system that are critical for the fish species that were that are the target of the proposal. They're critical for spawning. They're critical for juvenile survival. And in this particular, if you can go back one slide, many of those anchor habitats are in places where tributaries come in to the main stem of the Willamette River, and those tributary areas are highly productive for native fish species.
Okay, thank you for that.
Vice Chair Carter has something, too.
I noticed at the bottom of all your slides, you got partnerships. You see counties, cities, water, Nature Conservancy. Is there any industrial, non-industrial farm, ranch, cattle, and farm people who have adjacent lands to that partnership ending up with you in any way?
Many of those landowners are partners with the local watershed councils that are listed on that partner list there, such as the Lucky Mute Watershed Council, the Long Tom, the McKenzie. Those watershed councils often, as well as the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, are the ones that work in tandem with the landowners to work on these projects. In the case of the Willamette, much of the restoration that has happened to date has been on public land or lands that have been acquired through a conservation easement from our agency. And that will continue to be a focus of this project.
Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you. I don't know if I should wait till we're done with everything, but you brought up the sage grouse plan. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if under the sage grouse plan, if wind and solar farms are allowed to be built on the areas that are not allowed to have anything else put on them under the sage grouse plan.
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, thank you. So the projects that we will be funding will be they'll be working voluntarily with the landowners. These are primarily the SWCDs in Lake, Harney, and Malheur counties. We don't have a distinction if wind or solar projects should be or can be allowed on those properties that the landowners or where the SWCDs are working with the landowners. So
if I may follow up, I'm just trying to understand the plan a bit. It restricts business development and buildings and things like that. I'm asking if under the plan, if you know if wind and solar farms are allowed to be placed on land that is not being allowed any other use for commercial businesses, basically, or any sort of structures on it.
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, the plans that the districts are working under, they're looking at removing juniper, removing exotic grasses, marking fences. We are not in the regulatory realm here, and we're working strictly on a voluntary basis, or the districts are working on a voluntary basis.
I just want a yes or no, if I could, on the plan. Obviously, you understand the plan. Could you say yes or no? Are solar farms and wind farms going to be allowed on land that is not going to have anything else allowed on it for that sort of, construction or whatever?
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsett, I actually would have us defer to Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife primarily for that answer because they are overseeing the mitigation requirements and the development requirements. I would have to say our agency is less familiar with the details of that, so I can't give a response and confirm its accuracy for all of the lands.
Could you get back to us, please,
definitely.
With
we certainly
a definitive
can.
Answer if wind and solar farms are going to be allowed on lands?
We certainly can.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please proceed.
All right, next slide, please. Yes, and at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Courtney Schaff to talk about the other significant part of the Focus Investment Program, which is investing in partnership capacity.
Chair Witt, Committee, for the record, my name is Courtney Schaff, and I'm the Capacity Coordinator at OWEB. And the OWEB Board had the foresight to not only see the value investing in high-functioning partnerships through the Focus Investment Program, but also to invest in the capacity building efforts of our local partners through the capacity building program. So these grants support existing partnerships to complete high quality strategic action plans, which will result in increased effectiveness and efficiency of future restoration actions. So history tells us that high functioning partnerships are more resilient, sustainable, and effective at leveraging funds with other funders. So the hope in the future is that OWEB will be just one partner of funders investing in local restoration across the state. So OWEB staff will be working closely with these grantees throughout this grant period to reach the desired outcomes, which is increased partnership capacity and strategic plans. All these partners also have a bigger vision of, in the future, investing in restoration at a bigger scale. With that vision in mind, OWEB has been very clear with our communication throughout this process that the receipt of a capacity building grant does not automatically mean they will receive a future focused investment partnership program. And also, partnerships did not have to receive a capacity building grant in order to apply for a future FIP implementation grant. So now I'm just going to give you a quick overview of the 8 capacity building grants the OWEB Board awarded in January. The first is the Oregon Central Coast Estuary Collaborative. This is located in OWEB's Region 1. And these partners are working to restore and protect the estuaries along the Oregon Central Coast. And there's a great diversity of partners working on this project, including local watershed councils, soil and water conservation districts, and state and federal partners. The second is the Siuslaw-Coho Partnership, also located in OWEB's Region 1. This partnership is using the existing Coho business planning process to complete 2 additional action plans for 2 Coho populations on the coast, and is being led by the local soil and the local watershed council. The Umpqua Basin Partnership is located in OWEB's Region 2, and this group is trying to develop an action plan that will guide the restoration of the very checkerboard landscape of the Umpqua Basin. And really, the diversity of organizations and landowners that are represented within the Umpqua Basin are participating in this partnership. The Wild Rivers Coast Estuaries is located on Oregon's south coast and OWEB's Region 2, and they are working towards restoring 10 south coast estuaries. This group of partners has been working together for a very long time and is led by the local watershed councils and a soil and water conservation district down there. The Rogue Basin Partnership is working to take a more strategic and collaborative approach to restoration in the Rogue Basin, and the diversity of partners represent all the local interests down in the Rogue Basin, and they have been working together for quite a while to get to this point of the capacity building application. The Wallawa Fish Habitat Restoration Partnership is located in OWEB's Region 5. And this group, again, has been working together for a long time and has been very successful at restoration implementation, and they're using an existing process that they have refined in the past to develop restoration action plans for the Wallawa and Nimnaha River basins. And this project is led by the Grand Vaughan Model Watershed and has many local partners. And finally, the John Day Basin Partnership is located in OWEB's Region 6, And again, this partnership has been working together for a long time, and they're going to complete a strategic action plan so that it can work towards a more ecological approach to restoration in the basin. And this has a really diverse partnership of soil and water conservation districts, watershed councils, tribes, and state and local federal partners. And that is it.
Thank you all very much. Committee members, additional questions or comments? Vice Chair McLean.
Well, I was very lucky to have a mentor through my life, both in my educational world and then also someone who is just a real activist. But Dr. Rose Davis, who is in the Jackson County area, was a member of a couple of watersheds in the Soil Water Conservation District work and also an irrigation district down there, and worked on, I believe it was your region too, on many, many grants to help in that area. You talked about the long partnership, and she was involved in at least two or three of those different groups. And what I love about this program is the partner building. And so this new program, I think, sounds really exciting. And so what kind of a budget, you know, is that an ongoing budget opportunity there, or how does that work?
So Representative Chair Witt, Representative McLean, this for this, the 15-17 biennium, we had the OEB board set aside $1 million for the capacity building program for the FIP program. And we had a lot of interest. We received 23 applications and awarded 8 of those applications. And the 8 were really the stellar, the top of the top ready to move forward with their projects.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Krieger.
You mentioned earlier Measure 77 and funds available for research had to do with salmon. I'd like to have a conversation again with you on that. In fact, I had talked to the director earlier, but I'd like to continue that, if possible, before we leave Salem.
So if there, I can come up once there are any other specific questions, and we can speak to that.
Did you want to do that offline, or?
You can come to my office. That'd be great.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry that I missed part of the meeting, but I had something to attend to. And you may have outlined this before. I saw quite a bit of we were going to give $2 million, they're going to have $6 million. How much a year? And then you said we did $1 million a year. So what? Where are we getting the rest of the money?
So I can respond to that. Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel. So for the current biennium spending plan that was developed by the OEB board, $12.75 million was allocated for the implementation-ready focused investment partnerships, so the first 6 that you saw that included sagebrush, native fish habitat, and then, as Courtney referenced, $1 million was allocated for strictly the capacity building. So those final 8 efforts that she described that were focused on the partnership development and strategic action planning.
Follow up, please.
So, in other words, we gave out $2 million and somebody came in with $4 million to make $6 million total is what you're saying with all these partners, correct?
Yes. So, Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, each of the partnerships, both on the implementation and capacity building sides, brought in match, and in some cases, those were heavily matched and leveraged projects to the tune of, you know, multiple tens of millions of dollars in the Grand Ronde.
Thank you.
And for anyone who may be listening in the audience, the source of those funds would be what?
So, Chair Witt, a combination of fund sources, including Measure 76 state lottery funds and also Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Funds that are provided, that have been provided since 2000 by National Marine Fisheries Service to the state of Oregon.
And I don't want to get too far into the weeds on this, but just so that, again, the public would have a more complete understanding, Measure 77 allocates how much?
So 15% total between parks and natural resources. OEB receives 7.5% of those constitutionally dedicated lottery funds.
Thank you very much. I think that's helpful.
I had one.
Representative Esquivel.
Yep. And when you say Grand Ronde, I think of two places. So
yes.
I think of what we have in Western Oregon, then I know what we have over in Eastern Oregon as well. So I appreciate that.
Yes. Thanks for the clarification.
Anyone else? This is an opportunity for you to share with us from your perspective in terms of trying to restore and enhance the watersheds of our state. What are your biggest challenges, and what requests might you have of us as legislators to assist you in that mission? Please.
Chair Witt, thank you so much for the question. Again, for the record, Maida Lofsgaarden, Executive Director. I think a lot of what is needed from our perspective actually really has been done by the citizens of the state of Oregon, passing ballot measure 76, a permanent constitutional dedication of 7.5% of the lottery funds puts Oregon in a different spot compared to other states. We have money that's available to match with U.S. Department of Agriculture Farm Bill funds, with Fish and Wildlife Service coastal wetland grants and others that is just simply not available in other states. And we've seen the result of that. Oregon, through one of the Farm Bill conservation programs, was, I think, the largest or second largest recipient of funding through what's called the Regional Conservation Partnership Program, which matches the kind of investments that we're doing here. So I think one of our biggest challenges has been met by the availability of that funding. It also has made it possible for Oregon to be the largest recipient of the Pacific Coast Salmon Recovery Funds that Deputy Director Davis mentioned earlier. I think our next challenge really, as both Representative Krieger and you, Chair Witt, know, when this program, this amazing pilot was started back in 99 and earlier, we had an opportunity to pick up some low-hanging fruit. It's pretty easy to do riparian plantings. You heard the numbers from the Deputy Director about how much of that work we've done. What's next are big lifts. Opal Springs Dam is one. For Fish Passage is one that comes to mind that is probably a $7 million project. The Southern Floor Corridor work that's going on in the Tillamook area is millions upon millions of dollars. And so I think our biggest challenge moving forward is helping our local organizations to have that complexity and the capacity to be able to lift these next set of projects. The other piece that I think is critically important, and we're working with our districts and our councils and with folks like the Cattlemen and the Farm Bureau, is helping local private landowners just to be aware that this is available. The vast majority of the work that we do is on private farms and ranches with agriculturists who are very interested in doing this work on the ground. There's that next piece of helping folks who have not participated in these programs understand the benefits that come along with that.
Thank you very much. And I know you also mentioned 1999, and I think oftentimes we and the public at large assume that various state agencies have existed forever. And maybe just very briefly, what was magic about that year?
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. There were a number of local efforts that were going on in this state, I think, dating back to as early as 1985. My poor staff, I had the opportunity at Christmas to watch a video where we brought that history to bear that shows all of the work that went on in places like Bridge Creek all the way back to the mid-'80s, where environmentalists and ranchers in particular sat around the table and said, let's figure out a way to quit suing each other and find opportunities to work together collaboratively. Out of that work from the mid-'80s until 1999, there was first the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board, and in 99, we created the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. And so we're a really young agency compared to most others. We are a grand experiment. I often tell staff that we were set to expire in 2014, and for those first 15 years, we were sprinting a marathon just to show people that this kind of experiment can work, that we can do voluntary conservation and really achieve great gains. We've now had an opportunity to slow down with permanent funding that came in 2012 and really look long-term at what the needs are in the state, and that's where we result in the programs that we have now.
And committee members, I think in addition to all of the great volunteer work that so many individuals and groups and associations have carried out through OWEB. While OWEB did not invent the Oregon plan for salmon and watersheds, I think absent that plan and a lot of the good work that's made sure that plan in fact is working, and the restoration of our salmon has been with considerable success. All of the restorations that we saw in these films, I think, have made Oregon a very different place. And I think if that listing had ever taken place, we'd be living in a very, very different state with a lot of very, very different and probably onerous restrictions, along with the imperilment of some of our most favorite salmon, salmonid species. So thank you very, very much for all of the good work. Before I dismiss the panel, Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you. You mentioned the removal of the Opal Dam, and is OWEB, I didn't know if I heard that correctly, contributing $7 million towards the removal of the dam?
Chair Witt, excuse me, Representative Whitsitt, the dam will not be removed. In this case, they're going to do a combination of work to get better fish passage. If you look at the Round Butte Dam Complex and where fish are moving now that they're above, the first place that they bump into is the Opal Springs Dam. And so the work that's going on there is actually to keep that in place so that we can have continued water supply for that area around Madras, but at the same time provide much more adequate fish passage. And it's huge kudos to the Deschutes Valley Water District for the work that they've been doing. They're putting in $3.5 million towards this work to have fish passage. And then in addition to that, of course, the challenge is it's a $7 to $8 million project. And so the local partners are working to find funding. At this point in time, through actually the Deschutes Focus Investment, the local groups are considering $1 million of OWEB's funding to go towards that amount. They are also looking at federal fund opportunities, work through Department of Fish and Wildlife and others. So it is going to be one of those projects that is going to take a bunch of partners and a number of different funding sources to lift and support the local groups as they undertake this very innovative approach to getting fish passage sooner than what would be required under their typical FERC license.
Please.
Perhaps you could look at doing the same thing on the J.C. Boyle Dam on the Klamath River. It's in Klamath County. It has fish passage, but it needs to be updated. And one of the problems is that there's apparently no willingness to update the fish passage. And so I would urge you, instead of, I don't know if you support the removal of the dam or not, but to support the implementation of the fish ladders that are already there and upgrading them. So, thank you.
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, we'd be glad to follow up with the local partners there to see how we might be able to help.
And maybe Representative Whitsitt could be of some assistance with that, to that end as well. So
that would be excellent. Thank
Representative
you.
Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if this is more Department of Fish and Wildlife, but we know that culverts are a substantial problem across the state. Do you get involved with any projects related to that?
Chair Witt, Representative Gorsuch, Chair Witt is smiling because I would guess that many of the projects that he saw come through in his early years on the OWEB board were culvert replacement or removal. We do a lot of that work. We do it in very close coordination with Department of Fish and Wildlife and other agencies to make sure that what the local implementers design will meet that fish passage criteria. But that really, again, in many cases has been that low-hanging fruit that we're able to get in there and take those culverts and either make them larger or turn them into bridges or other opportunities. So, yes, we're very involved in that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Just an interesting note. I believe when I was on the OWEB board, total staff was 12 in the agency and the board was 17. The board was bigger than the agency.
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, we now are up to 35 in our agency, and we have learned that it takes two staff people to manage every board member.
About right.
Sure went down after I left.
Anyone else?
I just have a technical question real
Please.
Quick, Chair Witt. On your grant application cycle, and if you said it, I apologize, I didn't pick up on it. Is it a biennial cycle or an annual cycle?
Chair Witt, Representative McEwen, thank you for the question. We actually have a variety of cycles. So our open solicitation, which is the vast majority of our funding, typically runs on an every six-month cycle. So for our restoration technical assistance and those grants, we also then have our focus investment program. Our plan at this point in time is to run that on likely a biennial cycle. This is our very first test, and so we want to make sure we do it right, and we don't move either too quickly or too slowly. But that will at maximum be once a biennium for those larger scale investments.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. I think it's evident from the numbers of questions and comments that there's a great deal of interest on this committee in your work. Thank you for that good work. Please consider us friends and allies, and I would encourage you to work with Representative Whitsett to overcome that one fish passage bottleneck. With that, thank you very, very much. I'm going to close the informational hearing on OWEB and open an informational hearing on industrial hemp research at OSU. And call forward, please, Dr. Jay Noller. Welcome, sir. Good morning to you. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Honorable Chair Brad Witt and committee, for the record, my name is Jay Noller, and I'm a professor and head of the Department of Crop and Soil Science at Oregon State University. I've prepared some handouts, which you will be receiving here, which provide content on what I want to present. I thank you again for inviting me, and I want to talk about our plans to study industrial hemp and to support our stakeholders with interest in developing this historically important crop in Oregon. It is part of our mission as a land-grant university to respond to the needs of our agrarian stakeholders. Many Oregon farmers have expressed an interest in producing industrial hemp. However, grower success will be limited by significant gaps in knowledge. No relevant production information or technical support is available for the Pacific Northwest or Oregon production zones. The Agricultural Act of 2014 provides language enabling higher education institutions to conduct research on industrial hemp, therefore providing Oregon State University an opportunity to develop Oregon-specific agronomic information. The goal of our project is to evaluate the feasibility of industrial hemp produced for fiber, grain, and cannabinoids in field growing zones of Oregon. Our primary objectives are to evaluate industrial hemp varieties for suitability in Oregon, develop recommendations for growers across Oregon, and provide timely information to our stakeholders. Our pilot project is of 5 years duration and will be conducted mainly on the lands of the Oregon Agricultural Experiment Station. As with any field-based agricultural study, there is always the need and also the potential for unforeseen environmental factors such as drought, disease, insect infestations, and in addition to management errors that can occur, which would limit the feasibility or possibly the utility of a particular experimental site in a particular year. So 5 years is generally the minimum time required in agronomic science to gain enough data to provide robust results our stakeholders can rely on for many years. We have drafted a research proposal which addresses these points with details including schedule and budget, and I have provided that to you this morning. At present, we have no funds to support this. The major goal of this project is to accurately identify industrial hemp varieties that can provide commercial gains. Throughout the project, we'll use field plots on lands belonging to OSU, and during the first 2 years, only OSU lands will be used. In later years, that is the third, fourth, and fifth years, we will be considering using small plots on various growers' lands, typically under 5 acres, for our experiments, though the crop would be owned by and managed by OSU. to obtain the accurate and reliable predictions regarding yield potential of industrial hemp varieties in the diverse growing zones of Oregon. This project will engage OSU faculty at various research stations across the state in the second and later years. Research plots on grower fields may also be considered, again, in third, fourth, and fifth years. By year three, we should have a fair idea, at least beginning to have a fair idea, how to design an industrial hemp cropping system here in Oregon and how to make informed management decisions. Basically, we're looking at which varieties to select for desired end components and their expected yields, what the basic water needs are for this crop, it's a big question mark, which pests emerge and how they can be controlled. This project will offer an opportunity to identify and label pesticides for use in industrial hemp in Oregon.
Representative Gorsuch, a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. sorry to interrupt, but it comes to mind that I'm just wondering if the plans that are that you're working on, so this is very much focused on the production of the plant, are there also plans to think about what sort of industrial uses? I mean, I know people have used this for years, but in Oregon, is there some sort of idea about where this product will go to in terms of industrial hemp and the sorts of things that could be developed here? Is that part of this?
Chair Witt, Representative Gorsuch, we foresee that right now we want to answer the very basic question of will it grow in the state?
Right.
And then because we are growing it in the different zones, we'll be able to look at the qualities and the products that come out. As we harvest the grain, the fiber, the flowers, so that's basically the full scope, and we bring it into the lab, then we are looking at bringing on other researchers at OSU, again, within what is allowed by our registration with the Drug Enforcement Agency, and also as interest in funding in these allow. So right now, it's all open because we will have them. It's just a question of can we get seed in the ground.
And so it sounds like this is a natural progression. We're starting at the beginning, planting the plant, but that you do have plans to then try and expand where it can go from there.
Yes, Chair Witt, Representative Gorsuch, that is correct.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. And I think I had a question last week that you might be able to help answer. It's regarding water and how much water these various types of hemp are going to use around the state. So are you going to do studies that show what it will take in, say, northeastern Oregon or southeastern Oregon versus the Willamette Valley or Josephine or Jackson counties? Are you going to study that then or the different types of hemp? I understand they're all different types and they each require different amounts of water for the growing season, and sometimes the growing season is four crops a year or something they said. They called it quad crops or something like that.
Yeah.
So maybe you could just tell us if that's part of what Oregon State's going to work on.
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, yes, most definitely. As outlined even in this proposal in the pilot, one of the key things we're looking at is irrigated versus non-irrigated. Mm-hmm. So what is allowed by what naturally comes to the plant, and then what we apply. And then we'll have a structured approach to the irrigation, low, medium, high. And then also we're looking at different varieties, how they will respond to the amount of irrigation versus non-irrigation, and what sort of products come out. And so ultimately these are key issues for many of the growers as to when can we plant it. So we have scheduled planting dates, so a week to 2 weeks apart to find out. If you plant too early, you plant too late, what does this mean? And then, of course, the matrix of that includes the various applications of fertilizers and others. And ours initially is an open field setting. So that is sprinklers and rainfall that we get at the various stations that are allowed by local administration. So we're looking at counties. Some of ours are in or adjoining cities, and so we have to talk with the county judges and county commissioners and other people before we'll actually come in, because local ordinance may ban or not want that. And so these are conversations that we see for ahead. And so in those cases, that's where we see that perhaps in the third or later years, if we can't get into counties or in close to these jurisdictions, that maybe we'd be looking at similar growing zones that lie outside of that on private growers' lands. Just again, to answer the questions of how broadly is this plant, new crop, going to be useful to growers in terms of their crop rotations, as well as those who are interested in the product.
Committee members, I know that I've got questions on both sides of me, and I understand that there may be those questions that lose something if they're not asked at the time the presentation is made, but I would truly prefer, if we can, for the generalized questions to allow Professor Noller to give his presentation, and then I think we're going to have a substantial amount of time to ask some more in-depth questions. So if there's something that needs to be asked now, I'll entertain that. Otherwise, I'm going to let Professor Noller proceed. All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairman. Over the timeline of this project, we're looking at realistic assessments of the potential of this new crop across Oregon. And so the relevant data and the recommendations pertinent to that are important to our stakeholders will be disseminated through web-based information, demonstrations, field days targeted to growers in each region, and reference publications. With any new crop, there is initial concern of where to get seed. This is a concern today for industrial hemp growers. In anticipation of this need and growth in this industry, we have successfully ushered through to approval the seed certification standards for industrial hemp. We did this on Tuesday, and this is provided as part of your information package. This now provides the mechanism for farmers to grow industrial hemp for seed to sell to other farmers, as well as to ensure seed quality. This new standard allows for certification of seed production from fields and greenhouses. And I want to emphasize the last word, greenhouse. This also allows for future interstate and foreign trade in hemp seed. Industrial hemp production has returned to Oregon. Through the efforts of OSU faculty, we're looking forward to meeting grower needs today and tomorrow. I thank you for your time and attention this morning, and I will be happy to go back to answering questions that you may have.
Thank you very much. And I think Representative Witsa has a follow-up question, and she'll be followed by Representative Frederick.
Yes, thank you. I just wondered, can hemp, I know it's a fiber primarily, does it contain protein, and can it ever be used as a food source, not a supplement or whatever, but as a primary food source?
Chair Witt, Representative Witsit, yes, it can be used as a food source. It's not particularly high on the protein side in terms of if we're looking at a fiber plant. But there are varieties that can be used. The grain in particular is something that is used broadly for human consumption. Very high. It has a great suite of omega fatty acids, 3 and 6, and GLA and other components. And, of course, the cannabinoids, which come largely from the pressed flower, is useful for all sorts of different things. Multiple sclerosis is one, and others you probably have heard of.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I am really excited about this particular potential in terms of the plant. And what occurs to me is that this appears to be the model appears to be wheat. What you've done at OSU regarding wheat over the decades is where we are. We're setting up to really do well, and I'm looking forward to where we can grow it and how we can grow it. I am curious about what kind of response you are getting from farmers who have not had this particular plant. Where are they? What are they thinking about regarding this?
Chair Witt, Representative Frederick, good question. What I get from growers across the state, and certainly this would be from Malheur, Treasure Valley, the Columbia Basin, Central Oregon, Southwest Oregon, and here in the Willamette Valley, is that there's great optimism that is not born on heady estimates and profits and such, but rather that every farmer knows that they can't grow the same crop in the same plot of ground every year,
right.
And unless it's an orchard or vineyard, of course, but then we're not talking about a crop. in this these cases, they would they see this as a opportunity that in their rotation year, which may be a year where they would have a negative balance on their ledgers, they see the opportunity to bring in a second or third crop for the rotation, and that it could very well pay for itself in that year. They may be a grass seed farmer in the Grand Ronde Valley. They may be somebody who's currently cropping onions and potatoes out in the Treasure Valley, and they're running irrigated pivots. When I've talked to farmers from the small acre to the large ones who own dozens of these hundreds of acre center pivots, they see there's the potential that they will be able to bring this into the rotation. They see that there is definitely the desire, the imports of hemp currently into Oregon that they could meet. And because now we have the seed quality standards that we can actually bring in good seed, we can sell and trade seed within the state among growers, and that we could export it as a product. So not only meeting Oregon's needs, but also those outside of Oregon.
Thank you.
Thank you. Additional questions or comments?
Dr. Noller, I know that the legalization is very recent, and so I know much of your research is probably in its infancy, but would you anticipate developing different strains of industrial hemp for different climates around our state?
Yes, Chair Witt. Yes, I believe we will. We have there's two ways the germplasm for industrial hemp can get into Oregon. That which is already here, some people refer to it as stork seed. somehow it came here. And then there is the federally legally imported seed. I'm currently hold DEA registration for the transport of industrial hemp, so I can personally carry it, of course, with notice to the federal government, DEA. And those strains of industrial hemp would be those that we can source from overseas or from Canada. And those typically have protection on the intellectual protections, IP, or patents on them, or there would be material transfer agreements that we'd have to sign. But we could plant the seed, grow the crop, but we can't save the seed and replant that seed. And so that's currently a limitation as to what we can do with that. We have talked with growers here, hemp growers, and we are looking at them as potential sources to donate Oregon industrial hemp germplasm that we could then bring into a plant breeding program. And we would see that at that point we would take those strains and put them into our research plots. In fact, right now we have four empty slots in anticipation of this first year that Oregon growers would donate or lend us these seeds or microplants that we could culture and bring up and transplant.
So could you... I'm assuming it's a federal prohibition on planting second-generation seeds?
Chair Witt, there is interpretations, and the interpretations vary by the DEA from office to office, and it depends on who's in charge on the day that one asks.
I see.
If I may elaborate on that.
Please.
At present... I anticipate in the next month or so that I will be importing seed from Canada, from Manitoba. It'll be coming in, and we put it into a locker. It's all safe. We'll plant it in the ground, and according to one version of DEA, is that at that point the federal interest ends because we brought it across lines, and it's now destroyed by being put into the ground. What emerges after that is now, as long as state law allows and our Oregon Department of Agriculture is in agreement with us and we've had good conversations, we're in sync, then it's now considered an Oregon plant. It's an Oregon seed. It's there. On the other end of the interpretation is any seed that comes up, we have to account for and store in our places we can't share with others. And this is where we have watched Colorado, South Dakota, Kentucky, as they have learned, by depending on who they ask and who they're working with and who happens to be in charge at national, divisional, regional, state offices of the DEA.
That stork gets around. So... I don't want to ask you, first of all, I recognize that you can't speak for the DEA, and I don't want to ask you a question that in any way compromises your relationship with the DEA, but I'm trying to understand what it is that DEA, and I don't know if there are other federal agencies, are protecting against by prohibiting us from... germinating subsequent generations of seeds?
Chair Witt, it's the seed and any viable tissue is actually how it is said. So it could be leaf, flower,
okay,
something that has a cell. The cell could be cultured and can then be propagated. It's a Schedule 1A drug, which has the harshest penalties. In the Federal Register of Drugs, and they make no distinction as to whether it's marijuana or industrial hemp. When I filled out the registration for the DEA, there's only one checkbox, and that was for marijuana. Also, it was known to me that if we have any violations, I'm the one who goes to jail for 10 years.
Yes, I understand, regardless of whether it's psychoactive or not.
Correct.
I understand very well. That's unreasonably harsh, I think. Representative Whitson.
That was a question that I was going to ask, and he started it. Why is it considered a Class 1 drug? Is it because it is from the family of marijuana, because it's not supposed to be psychoactive or psychotropic or whatever? I've wondered that as I was going through the bills. One of the reasons I voted against all the hemp things was because it is considered still a federally classified drug, and we have the Federal Supremacy Clause, which says we can't override the federal government. And so, you know, I just was wondering, is it because it's related to marijuana?
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, I do believe that is the case.
Okay.
And it's hard to tell a cannabis sativa plant that has low THC, i.e., industrial hemp for one that has a little higher.
Unless you test it.
I know so little about it. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Additional questions or comments? Well, Dr. Noller, thank you so very much for your presentation and your patience with all of our questions. We would look forward to the opportunity, hopefully in the very near future, to see on the ground applications of all of your research that's has the potential, I think, here for such a great economic development for our state. So thank you for being here. Thank you for your wonderful work. And we're always delighted to have presentations from OSU.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Witt.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. And with that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on industrial hemp. And committee members, do we have anything for the good of the order? Mr. Roper, what do we have Tuesday?
Tuesday, we're still putting together perhaps an informational session that will involve officials from the U.S. Forest Service. Mm-hmm. And perhaps we will also have a bill referral that would come today. We're still waiting to find
from
out.
From the Senate side.
All right. Anything further? Representative Esquivel.
Mr. Chair, this last session, we went pretty extensively on the western juniper and what effect it's having on our state.
Yes.
And we as a state didn't allocate, in my opinion, nearly enough money to even stop it or keep it at bay. Mm-hmm. So maybe this committee could get together and have a bill, a committee bill, okay, requesting at least a $20 million input by the state of Oregon, which should do about 200,000 acres.
Yeah.
Because right now we're still losing out.
Yeah.
And is that something, Representative Esquivel, that you might be interested in us discussing further, say, in a May meeting?
It would be wonderful.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
All right.
Sounds like a good idea.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Anything further? With that, we are adjourned. Thank you all, everyone. Everyone. Further? With that, we are adjourned. Thank you all.